Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Z47, Zero to Infinity. B2B manufacturing is not that intuitive a sector that all founders decide to start up in, right?
So, scale does not necessarily bring about profitability. Right. It's more to do with if there's fundamental value being created and you have margins right from day one.
How is India positioned vis-a-vis China in terms of just pure metal manufacturing capability?
What parts we manufacture is very varied. Components for autonomous underground mining systems, the massive machine. We make parts for submarines today, casings for bombshells for Indian defense.
But why go completely full stack? Why do the raw material business, which probably slightly lower margin?
One word, control. Right from day one, what we really wanted to do was become an extension of a buyer's factory. Tech in India is minimal and there's a long way to go before they can come anywhere close to what China is. It started off by chance when we got into it, very honestly. But the moment we realized that this has got great opportunity, now we are completely in.
I'm Sudipto, and with me I have Sharon, co-founder and CEO of Zimcart. Zimcart is a custom metal manufacturing exports platform that plays to our developed nation building theme. And today we have the privilege of chatting with Sharon and learning more about both his journey as well as what Zimcart is doing. So welcome, Sharon.
Thank you, Sudipto. Good to be here.
Before we go into Zimcart, right, maybe let's start with a little bit of your background and journey.
Sure.
And obviously, B2B manufacturing is not that intuitive a sector that all founders decide to start up in, right? So tell us a little bit about your journey, your background, and what inspired you to build in B2B.
I think for me, B2B and manufacturing come from my two successful or my most impactful professional stints. The first one with Tata Motors, where I was in the manufacturing plant in Chakan, Pune, role right off the campus. And the second with Udaan, in the early days of B2B, when B2B was fairly new in India and everybody was trying to figure out what to do with B2B, and we were doing things at unbelievable scale at those times, right? So I think those two stints is what set both manufacturing and B2B deeply into me. Now, why B2B? Interestingly, for me, there are three fundamental reasons. One is the scale of B2B, right? It more often than not has infinite TAM, if you pick the category right. The second is it's a no-nonsense business. You deliver value to your customers, clear, measurable value. And that's largely where you can exist. If you don't, you're out. So that's the way we wanted to build the business. And the third is, interestingly, you have to innovate because the traditional parallel is fairly capable and smart. So if you have to find gaps, if you want to innovate, if you want to find value-generating systems, you really need to think through and be able to either beat them at it or, even better, leverage them and build something large. And I think the latter is what we intend to do, but that's largely why B2B is exciting for me and why absolutely whole and heart certain that's the space we love and we want to be in.
Very interesting, Sharon. And as you know, I've been spending a lot of time on B2B manufacturing now almost for a decade. So very heartening to hear. But also B2B has challenges in terms of thin margins, ROCE, etc., which we'll cover later. But before that, obviously, you spent a lot of time in Udaan, right? And building a lot of zero to ones in Udaan as
Correct.
Well. What were your learnings from that journey in Udaan and how that influenced your thought process in building Zimcart?
Oh, yeah. Udaan for me was all about scale, right? I mean, B2B was very new, like I said. Jio was just about coming in. So the retail penetration of data was very early back in the day, 2018, 2019, right? What Udaan taught me was, you know, don't worry about scale. And scale is something which is natural. The complexities which come at scale is something which is going to make you tougher, better. You're going to solve for a lot of newer things. So I think Udaan was all about scale. The second piece is, interestingly, India is very, very diverse. So B2B sort of follows that a system across the country. You have regionalism, you have community-based business that happens. You have different sections of the country operating differently in terms of their policies. Some are volume drivers, some are margin drivers. So how do you sort of navigate through that? That's an exposure which came about. And one of the learning I would say is profitability very early in B2B. You really cannot look at it down the line. Scale does not necessarily bring about profitability. It's more to do with if there's fundamental value being created and you have margins right from day one, that's just going to continue right until the end of the journey, right? So that's largely what sort of was a learning from. And one other thing was the thing about B2B is you need to really go deep into the value systems. So horizontal versus vertical. If you really need to make the margin play, you need to look at it at the entire supply chain system. You really cannot cut systems once you've achieved scale. But when you're starting out, especially, you need to be super verticalized, because whatever you can generate out of different, I'll say, intermediaries in a particular value system, that's largely what your margin is going to be. So I think some of these things is what sort of came about in Udaan. And that's largely what we did. So scale, the pan-India sort of distribution, understanding of how each individual is different, and profitability and verticalization is largely, I would say, the best learnings that I got from Udaan.
No, makes sense. And we also have a very strong thesis on vertical B2B marketplace. Because as you mentioned, customer is different, supplier is different, the supply chain is completely different, margin structure, logistics, working capital. Absolutely. It is so different that if you are building a horizontal company, you are building actually 10 different independent companies.
Correct.
And for any startup, the most important thing is focus, right? So
yes,
completely aligned on vertical B2B marketplaces. Now, coming back to the 3 points you touched, right, which is obviously TAM and scale, then what moat that you can build,
sure,
profitability, all the interesting things that you touched from your Udaan journey. With all of those learnings, why custom metal manufacturing platform, right? So maybe break it down, demystify, why is this an exciting space? And with the vectors that you thought about, why did you decide to build in this sector?
I think the core vector we looked at was, this is an industry which is so deep-rooted and something which is super fundamental in everything that we do. So it touches every human being in pretty much every aspect of life, right? I mean, you don't realize the car you drive, the smartphone you use, even the zippers on your clothes, right, have metal products, which for some reason we take it for granted. We really don't think about it as much, because it's seen as an yesterday's problem, not a tomorrow's opportunity. The way we looked at it, and we felt it is an yesterday's problem, but there's a lot of things currently available in today's market which we can leverage, largely being tech, and see what we can deliver out of this. Now, because it's metal manufacturing and super fundamental, the TAM is literally infinite, right? When you look at it from that standpoint. And when we started our journey from materials and then went forward towards getting customers, what we realized is the value system had a lot to offer if you were to leverage the largely the tech and systems that we currently are very exposed to and take for granted and overlay it on the traditional ecosystem, which is where we felt this is an industry we really want to get into. Like I said, it started off by chance when we got into it, very honestly. But the moment we realized that this has got great opportunity, now we are completely in. And I don't think we don't want to do anything different at this point in time.
Got it. Understood. Maybe for a little bit of flavor, what are the different kinds of parts? Like, what do you manufacture? When you say custom metal manufacturing, right?
Sure.
What kind of products and parts do you manufacture? What kind of factories do you work with?
Sure.
Who are your typical customers? Just to get a little bit of flavor of the business.
What parts we manufacture is very varied. We make components for autonomous underground mining systems, the massive machines. We make parts for them. We make parts for submarines today. We make casings for bombshells for Indian defense. We make parts for electric switchgears. We make parts for Delhi and Jaipur metro. We make parts for agri-harvesters and pumps and valves and auto components and so on and so forth. Now, when I say this, the industry sectors seem very broad.
Yeah.
But the linking,
but I'm sure
is the
there
process.
Will be an underlying manufacturing layer and raw material supply chain behind it, right?
Yes. So the interesting part is how we think of it is there's a thinking loop and an execution loop. What I largely talk about is the thinking loop is where we've sort of solved for, which sort of gives us the capability to handle any different part for across any different sector. The execution loop is largely the same. Once you solve for the thinking loop and you're feeding in the right inputs to the execution loop, you can manufacture any part at any size using any material to get to the customer, like I've mentioned, right? So while we worked across these many sectors, operationally, we are no different when we look at, let's say, a submarine to a bombshell probably. And that's how we look at it.
Very interesting way that you broke it down, thinking loop and execution loop. So let's maybe deep dive a little bit more, right? What's the thinking loop? And let's take maybe two examples. Thinking loop for a submarine company and thinking loop for maybe auto, right?
Sure.
What is thinking loop? And then if you break down to execution, what are the different pieces of execution for both? And what's the similarity between the two,
two
end outcomes?
Absolutely. And I'll keep it simple. For a submarine, let's say the number of parts you need for the part we manufacture is not in very high volumes, but it's super precise. The finish has to be extraordinarily immaculate. And it's extremely high intensity machining of the part. When it comes to auto, you typically have volume as a problem statement. You have cost as an attribute that you'll have to keep your mind on, right? And probably some bit on material composition is something you keep in mind. Now, when you look at these two use cases, your starting point largely is the same. Both those customers are going to give you drawings. with certain restrictions on what they want from those particular parts. Now, from then on, factoring all the elements I mentioned in terms of finish quality, in terms of composition of material, in terms of the volumes you need to manufacture, both these have very different initial starting points. Once you sort of solve for that differentiation, when you lay it at a factory flow, it's the same production workflow. The volume changes, that's a different aspect, but the checkpoints, the QC gates, the systems that you do, the pattern making, the casting into it, the fettlings, the machining part of it is largely standardized because you've already thought through what are all the checks and systems you need to build in advance and sort of lead it out onto your production system. So whatever thinking has to do, whatever differentiation you have to bring about, it's happening on the initial phase. And then and thereabout is just about following instructions and executing it.
Very interesting the way you put it. And I definitely like the classification of thinking loop and execution loop. Let's maybe spend a little bit of time on actually the execution loop and factories. And then I'll go back to your customers. But you took a very conscious choice of being completely vertically integrated, which means do the raw material sourcing, then build tech for your factories, and then build the custom metal manufacturing business on top, right? Vertical is clear. But why go completely full stack? Why do the raw material business, which probably is slightly lower margin? Why build tech for factories in India? And then we'll go to custom metal manufacturing. But what influenced these choices?
Absolutely. One word, control. Right from day one, what we really wanted to do was become an extension of a buyer's factory. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The best case scenario for any global buyer is to have his own factory where his parts are being manufactured at great levels of control. Now, outsourcing happens for various different reasons, predominantly being cost. And then they have to sort of depend on different intricacies of the factory that they're dependent on, right? And that's largely how it works. So when we started out, what we felt was, if we were to become a marketing representative of those factories, we are then taking forward all the specific deficiencies, I would say, that factory would have right up until our customer. And that's not something we were okay to do. Which is where we said, first principally, we need to control whatever happens in that facility, right? Before we can go to a customer with complete control and say we can deliver your part like it's from your own factory. And that starts with the raw materials. Raw materials today is 50% of any metal manufacturing, which means roughly anywhere between 25 to 30 different metal components go into every part that gets manufactured.
And how much of that is domestic versus imported?
Oh, 60%+ is imported because most of the core input to this is what we call as recycled metals or scrap, which India just does not generate enough or does not have structured systems to generate it internally at this point in time. So we depend on a bunch of countries today. So for us, from a material standpoint, we import from around 20-odd countries, around 25 different products, which are super fundamental to these factories, which gives us the control, which gives us pricing systems, which gives us some bit of traceability of where the material comes from, right up until what goes into the factory that we work with. What materials also led us to is it gave us access to the shop floor, which otherwise we might not have access to. As a buyer, we would have had, but buyers eventually come downstream. With this access to shop floor is where we were able to build our first production management system, which is deeply sort of mapping out factory level differences, ways of operations, regional level differences, and coming up with what we felt was the most optimum way to produce a particular part in terms of work orders, projects, workspaces, and so on, right? And that's largely is the first version zero of what we built in terms of a production management system. And most of our tech today is built on top of this. And that's largely why raw materials and production systems as a leeway to our control mandate became super critical for us before we went to our buyers.
And as I hear you say, obviously, that's also the way most of manufacturing in China operates, right? Where they control raw material supply from all around the world of various different sort of materials, including critical minerals. Correct. And then everything comes into China and they essentially obviously have the super factories that manufacture and then it gets exported to the world. And
absolutely.
Broadly, I think that's the model you are also following where you import raw materials from the world, get in manufacturing in Indian factories, then export it to the world.
Absolutely.
Now, obviously, as we think of comparison between China and India, right? One fundamental difference is capability of those factories.
Correct.
Use of tech, use of automation, skilled labor, capabilities of factories. Correct. How is India positioned vis-a-vis China in terms of just pure metal manufacturing capability? That's the first part. And second, generally it's very difficult to adopt tech in Indian factories. So how have you gone about building tech for Indian factories and manufacturers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Indian factories do use tech, but this is largely limited to accounting, inventory management, and some bit of audit and compliance requirement, right? Beyond that, most factories today do not necessarily use tech, definitely not in production lines and systems. The reason why we built our production management system was largely because we felt our Indian factories do not use it. What this means fundamentally from a Chinese comparison is that our factories typically end up missing out on SLAs, have quality deficiencies because they don't necessarily operate in a structured way a production system should work in terms of traceability, tracking, and optimizing for it during the production process, which leaves a lot of gap from a customer experience standpoint, right? When people look at China and people look at India, India has the technical capability to a decent degree to be a very good replacement for what China does today. But where it definitely lacks is in terms of this professionalism, which we can call it out as, right? Which is, it's fairly okay in Indian ecosystem perspective to have slight up and down in terms of quality. It's fairly okay to have a 3-4 week SLA delay, which is seen as a minor error in terms of the manufacturing timeline. Now, when you look at a customer globally, they're not okay with it because they have been tuned to what China does today. China is absolutely like clockwork.
And the supply chain is built around that. So they the SLAs to be met because that's how the entire supply chain works.
Absolutely, absolutely. They don't want to keep buffer inventory basis the supply that they're going to work with. They want to be as light as they can. Everything has to come almost just in time, which means this has to be run like a extension of their own factory, like I mentioned. It can't necessarily be an outsourcing project where they are dependent on the supplier's inefficiencies, right? So that's how tech works. So answer in short, tech in India is minimal and there's a long way to go before they can come anywhere close to what China is. Where they're similar with, because you asked the question on where do we lie with respect to China, India has enough capacity. India has enough infrastructure in the industry, which is what we are leveraging. What they don't have is professionalism to the extent that the global customers want. And they don't have global exposure at this point in time. Most of Indian factories have manufactured for domestic buyers. All the different processes and systems and variations which the global buyers want in terms of, let's say, very high tolerances, Indian customers have not necessarily taken that up at that level of scale. So there's a bit of familiarization which is required, which we currently bring into them.
Got it. And what's the pieces of tech that you have built to solve for the challenges on SLA, quality, TAT, professionalism, service quality?
Absolutely.
What have you built in tech and how does it solve each of these individual pieces and take Indian manufacturing to a global level?
So for us, tech is largely built around 5 pillars. And that's the way we see metal manufacturing today. The first is what we call as product design, which is you can give us any drawing across any sector. The system should be able to tell what process, what production systems to follow, which eliminates human need because this is largely a very old problem statement. It's largely a system of what are all the parameters and mapping your part to it and then delivering the part. So that's the first piece we work on. The second and the most critical is how do we match a part to a particular manufacturer, which is what we call as supplier matchmaking. How we go about doing it is we've built this ecosystem looking at around 75 plus parameters of the manufacturers in India. And we, for a great degree, are able to match a particular part to a particular supplier very, very well, which sort of helps us downstream. The third, which sort of addresses the SLA issues, is what we call as the production management system or production automation, which is a plethora, a step-by-step process workflow of around 30 plus different activities, which start from designing the pattern, which is the first step of manufacturing, right until the machine part comes out from the facility, right? Which is assigned to specific stakeholders. It could be internal, external. There's multiple quality gates, which sort of give you triggers and flags on when something needs to be monitored by a human and what can be tracked by the system, and the part can come out. The fourth is quality. Quality is super important. So we go about designing quality for every part, just because, I mean, no one part will have a standard quality check. Each will be looked at from what the part is, what the part application is, and the quality will then be designed accordingly, which is the fourth piece. The fifth is what we call a central product intelligence, which is our first step towards complete automation of a factory, which is when you manufacture a part, how do you capture every single attribute around the process of manufacturing? So that tomorrow, if you need to manufacture the part, you don't need any human intervention to come in and tell you what to do in the part manufacturing. The system should be automatically able to take the part and get you to the final product, which we believe is the first step towards complete automation. And that's largely how we look at it. So these are the 5 broad pillars around which we build tech.
And how do you get factories to adopt?
So fundamentally, the way factories have started adopting it is because we brought in demand, very honestly. But what happened because of that is factories now are accepting the concept that because they're working on multiple different products from us, they need to now start using system. Because if they don't use system, it's going to be a complete mess. For instance, we currently work with around 45-50 factories where our products are being manufactured. And there are roughly around 5,000 plus steps which multiple stakeholders have to be answerable for at different timelines let's say around a 2 to 8 week window. Now, in that ecosystem, if the factory is not necessarily working on that regimen, the part does not come out on time or in the right quality. So it's through the demand we've brought in, we've been able to get the factories to adopt tech. It's a work in progress, but like I said, the 40 or 50 factories we work with are now starting to adopt all these facilities, all these tech features we brought about.
So now we have the supply of raw materials, which is imported and domestic. These come into these 40 or 50 factories that we work closely with. They have started using your tech. So the capability, hopefully, now we've established on how do you build metal manufacturing for the world, right? So the toughest part of B2B exports is demand. At least in the last 5 years, having looked at multiple different companies, I think, although Indian manufacturing capability has been slightly behind, when you get demand, the manufacturers step up.
Absolutely.
The challenge is getting global demand, right? So how did you go about building your customer base? But before you answer that, is China Plus One real? And have you seen that happening on the ground? And then tell us a little bit about what was your GTM in going and attracting large global customers?
Absolutely. Answer the question of China Plus One. It's absolutely real. I can't be more emphatic on it, right? Now, why is China Plus One real today, right? Now, if you look at metal, precision metal manufacturing market, right? China is sitting at a comfortable 50%-ish market share, $100 billion plus industry.
How large is India?
India is 10-11%, does around $20 billion. And it's the second, by the way. So the first one is at 50, 45, 50. The second is at 10-12%, right? So what's happened over the last 20-30 years for most of the Western buyers is they have been settled on China. China was on its growth spurt. We all know very well about it since 1978, around that period. And customers have been attuned to what China offers, never really having to look at anything beyond. What changed? COVID, first step, right? Post-COVID, people started feeling that supply chain needs some bit of de-risking. They needed to look at alternate geographies. And current systems that we hear about, tariffs and other things, definitely is adding on to it, right? But the conscious call for any procurement manager or supply chain director is to say that you can't just be dependent on one country anymore. I mean, the world is not necessarily very, very, for lack of a better word, static from that standpoint, right? A lot of things are moving, a lot of things are changing. And when you sort of list down the country to go after next, what's the closest second in terms of market share is in India, in terms of pricing is India, in terms of capability is India, which makes India a very, very clear alternate to what China has offered to them for the past 20, 30 years. And that's largely what we see from our customers, right? So logically, on why India is now picking up the demand is China is just too large today. So any market share has to come in from China. And second, India is the closest second. So any plans of alternate supply chain has to come to India. And that's largely what's been trickling down. We see this across most of our customers. I mean, it's more severe, especially in the North American market, right? And it sort of is as critical in the Western European geographies as well, right? And that's largely what we've seen. Now, in terms of how we went about our GTM is a combination of factors. One was obviously trade shows. This is an industry which is very, very close-knit. People do attend trade shows and people do necessarily socialize and want to understand new suppliers and new systems which come into the market. So that's largely where we got started. After the trade shows, largely it was about the agency ecosystem. For example, the US market works well on agents. There are enough industry experts who are in the market, who have enough understanding and depth and partners that they can work with, provided they have good supply partners that they can depend on. And that's something we use for the US market. But the most effective one, if I might put it that way, has been the direct reach out through emails. And that's been our most critical or most effective go-to-market sort of a tool that we've used to sort of get the customers. The reason why it's worked for us is the point I came back to initially, the control that we're able to bring in. So every customer we talk to, they resonate with the concept that we probably bring the best control in supply chain, which they know that they need for India. If anyone has tried India before, they understand that without this control, you really don't have that level of experience that you probably expect from China to come through from India. And that's largely why we've been able to get most of our responses through very, very targeted and pointed email communication.
Going back to where we began, right, and the different use cases of custom metal manufacturing, and you spoke about submarines and defense and auto. Give us a little bit of flavor of who are these customers, right?
Absolutely.
Do they have procurement sourcing teams in India? Are they sourcing from India for the first time? So give us a little bit of flavor of the kind of customers, expectation from India, and understand the control and quality piece.
Sure.
Just to get a flavor of, are they new to India or sure. They had sourcing arms in India, but that did not work. they're trying India for the first time. So who are they?
Before I get into the company names, why do customers look at India? There are three broad headers on why they sort of work with us. The first is fresh sourcing, where they've not looked at India. They've looked at China for the longest time. And now they're moving to India. So they're obviously very new to the Indian market. The second is what we call as resourcing, which is they've looked at India. They've tried with a few parties, but they've never been comfortable or happy. And they've been doing it for a while now. And they feel that they need a professional ecosystem to sort of support them at this point in time. The third is technical complexity. They might have parts which the Indian manufacturer is not able to sort of handle the same way as, let's say, some of their other geography manufacturers are. And they want us to sort of pick that up and solve it for Indian manufacturer and make the part for them. So all three combinations come into it. The customers we manufacture for today, our biggest customer happens to be Komatsu, which is a Japanese global giant, multi-billion dollar industry. We make underground components for their underground mining machines. For the UK market, we're soon starting the US market. We do have a customer called Hydac, who is again a billion-dollar enterprise in hydraulic systems based out of Germany. We do manufacture for the German unit. We are now in talks to start supplying for the Indian unit. We supply parts for a company called Daniel, which is in pumps and valve systems, which is an ex-Emerson Group company, which is an $80 billion enterprise. We make parts for a company in Switzerland called Vanflu, which is a very niche engineering company which makes parts for submarines. We make parts for Jindal in India, which is largely for all the projects of metro work that they do across Mumbai, Pune and Jaipur metro.
So if I take a Komatsu or a Hydac, right? Take us through the entire experience and journey.
Sure.
How did you reach out to them? How did they actually trust you with pilot sort of parts and components? And how did that relationship grow?
Yeah, so Komatsu was a trade show convert for us. We met the sourcing team at a trade show. What worked with Komatsu is they traveled to India last November to visit one of our facilities, our partner facilities. They actually landed because of the control story, right? When they realized that we have control at a facility, right, from raw material leading up to production systems and owning the technical complexity of the part. And that's something we maintain in-house today, which is an extension of their design team, which our team can pick up and sort of handle on the product. Komatsu landed because of this continuous value system that we offer today, right? And that's largely why we sort of work with Komatsu. Like I said, it's the UK unit of Komatsu that we make parts for today. But now because we've been able to deliver some value there, the US team is now looking at us, which is the larger organization of the same, or the parent entity of the same. When it comes to Hydac was an email convert, by the way. Obviously, they had concerns. Pumps is seen as a little more technical product. It's not easy sourcing when you look at pumps. They obviously had a lot of questions with us on how we would address the problem statement. We had a lot of technical conversations on how would we go about making their part. They've tried India in the past. They were looking at technical competence and they were looking at price competence, both of which we could offer to them. And that's largely how we've been able to start. The validation on why it's working is now they've recommended us to the India unit as well, right? Which is largely a manifestation of how good our technical team is and our price capability with the supply partner that we work with. And that's largely why Komatsu and Hydac have largely come aboard.
A lot of what you said, like tech, quality, control, getting to these global customers is a very strong team, right? And hiring for B2B, especially manufacturing, is not easy. So what have you done and what kind of backgrounds have you seen work well for B2B and manufacturing industry?
Yeah. I think there are two cohorts for it. Absolutely critical two cohorts of team that you need to build out, right? One is what we call as a generalist, right? People who come from pedigree colleges, who have done various different problem solving across consulting and product and so on, right? Which is the anchor of most startups that we have today. But because we do B2B, and I mentioned about a traditional parallel, if you have to beat or if you have to come as good as a traditional parallel, you have to take inputs from the traditional parallel ecosystem as well, which is the other layer of the team that you need to hire, which is people who've spent the longest amount of time building what we call as the incumbent or the traditional parallel. So what we've gone about doing is we've gone ahead and hired people with 15, 20 plus years of experience across every process in metal manufacturing, but with very similar mindset to us, right? People who are in that domain.
So the first one is obviously obvious, right? All startups have this general first principles thinking, problem solving cohort. As you think about hiring from industry, and there will be a lot of people with experience, right?
Correct.
But what do you look for at Zimkart
before
making an offer to people from the traditional industry?
Two elements to that again. One is technical depth. Obviously, they should have demonstrated enough product handling capability or manufacturing expertise over the period of years they've been working in the traditional ecosystem. But the most important is, do they have hunger? What tends to happen, and it's not something I want to generalize, but you more often than not see that people are more than happy and settled at where they are. We look at people who are a bit of a different breed, people who are a bit jittery at where they sit at, people who dream big, people who want to do newer things, people who are not okay with just doing what they've been doing. They're very good at what they do, but they feel that they need to do a lot more. So our production head, for instance, is doing a program or course in AI at this point in time, which something is one of the reasons probably I hired him, right? So, which is unheard of. I mean, you would not find a hardcore factory production manager who is doing a course at Bits Pilani on AI and AI in manufacturing, right? So, which sort of gives you a sense on the kind of people we want to bring in and the people we've brought into the system.
Got it. Fantastic. So, we've covered the raw material supply chain, tech, the exports business, team. What are the big challenges today? So, if you think about the next 12 months as you go about building this business, right?
Correct.
0 to 1 is done.
Correct.
You're in the journey of doing 1 to 10.
Correct.
For 10 to 100,
correct.
What are the big challenges that worry you today?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge for me is how do you ensure quality at scale? What we do today is great at the early scale volumes that we are currently doing, but quality issues manifest when you go to higher scales. One aspect of this is obviously the kind of tech we are investing in, AI, and how we sort of figure out quality differences and sort of match product towards the initial design of the part. But that's an area which is an open area in my opinion, right? Which is we need to solve for it a lot better as we scale and as we start making more products. So that's one area where we find we need to be better at. The second is today most of the manufacturing that we do, we don't necessarily capacity block. We keep it at a order to order level with our manufacturing partners. Like I said, it's about stable supply chains. We just need to sort of probably block capacities and, you know, have a fixed level of utilization planned and blocked at an advanced system basis, which is something I think these are the two things, quality and probably capacity blocking at all facilities that we work today, which obviously at the scale that we are in, we're not doing at this point in time, but at downstream, we do intend to get into that. Beyond these two, I think in terms of demand, I think touchwood, we are very blessed with 250 plus different partners across 10 odd different geographies and similar sort of sectors looking at us and evaluating with us and working at different levels of closure at this point in time. So demand is a bit covered, but obviously we do plan to invest into GTM at some point in time. But more importantly, it's on quality and the capacity that we carry, which is blocked and reserved for us. Those are two areas which we look at.
Got it. Understood. Good. Fantastic, Sharan. Final question from my end. What's the vision with Zimkart? What's your personal aspiration and goal? And what's the vision of building Zimkart? Maybe 5 years, 10 years down the line.
Yeah, I think everything metal, which is designed to component, right? We want to be the one-stop shop. Absolutely. It's an area where we don't see Pareto. We don't see very large players. It's super fragmented. There's a very clear role for tech and which we are trying to build and bring about. Infinite demand. Enough sectors, enough industries, enough geographies are looking at India as a sourcing center. And good margins, which mean the business is good on ROSI. The business is defensible because you build you're not a supplier to a buyer, you're more of a supply partner to a buyer, which is a very different statement when you think of how much the buyer invests with you to get his parts created, his or her parts created. So I think from all these perspectives, like I said, we want to be the one-stop destination for metal manufacturing out of India, leveraging tech, which then leads us to probably a very, very good IPO journey in the next 5 to 6 years, considering all the parameters in terms of ROSI, in terms of TAM, in terms of defensible business. And that's largely the plan over the next 5 to 6 years.
Got it. Fantastic. Thank you, Sharan, for the time. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast. Hopefully, this gives you a little bit of flavor of all the innovation that's happening in India, especially in the broad Make in India trend lines. We see it daily as we speak to our portfolio companies on how the Indian manufacturing landscape is transforming. We see a lot of innovation happening across manufacturing, different pieces of manufacturing. And hopefully, through this conversation, we brought in a little bit of flavor of what's happening in metal manufacturing in India today. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you like this episode of Zero to Infinity, there are so many more that you must check out. If you like Indian startup content, hearing about founder journeys, or knowing more about emerging sectors that we're investing in, Zero to Infinity is the channel that you need to subscribe.